Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to new and returning listeners. I am Dr. Danica Ramsey-Brimberg and your host of this episode of New Books in Irish Studies under New Books Network. I am excited to welcome Fintan Walsh, archaeologist and author of the recently published The Road to Kells, Prehistoric Archaeology of the M3 Navan to Kells and N52 Kells Bypass Road Project. Welcome, Fintan, to the project, for the podcast, sorry.
Thank you very much for having me, Danica. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Would you tell us a little about yourself?
Okay, well, I'm primarily a field archaeologist. I've been working in the field since the late 90s, basically. It was well over 20 years, so quite old. I studied in Queen's University of Belfast. And since graduating in 97, I've worked for numerous archaeological consultancies across Ireland. And primarily I've been working on large-scale excavations across Ireland and road schemes and other private developments. So got to see nearly every part of Ireland through the years and excavated nearly, well, not every type of site, but I would think quite a few of the ones that are that you would expect to find in developments.
And was that how you got involved with the excavations along this particular road and the bypass, as well as the process of publishing, the synthesis of the findings?
That's right. So the company I worked for at the time, Irish Archaeological Consultancy, were one of the contractors for this scheme. As it happens, I was the excavation director for one of the larger sites there at Kilmainham. So through that, I was involved in the project on the ground, and as it came into the post-excavation stage where reports were written and all the specialist data was collected, I had a bit more of a role at that stage. So to myself and my colleague Jill McLaughlin, we got the task of pulling all that information together, getting reports out the door, and I was handed the task of trying to combine all this information into a digestible book, basically, which was part of the contractual requirements for the scheme as well. But it was a task of taking all the site data and trying to get into something interesting. Not interesting, but digestible, I suppose.
But it is really interesting. And with all that information, because you cover in the book everything from 4,500 BC, so the late Mesolithic, to 600 AD, the early medieval period, how was that process of trying to condense all of that information from the 43 sites?
So I suppose it was worthwhile, or it was useful to be part of the report writing phase and interaction with specialists and all of that data that came about in the process. But there's quite a lot of information between all the sites in terms of, you know, the data, the specialist results, the radiocarbon dates, etc. So what we did is we basically story mapped it in a way, you know. We created a big sheet and we drew out the scheme, marked on the sites, and then we wrote down notes and did pictorial imagery of what each of the sites were, what the date ranges were, what kind of archaeological material came from those sites. And from that, basically building up a timeline, we tried to tell the story from the earliest inhabitants in the Mesolithic period right the way through, just in reference to all the other sites, in reference to the landscape, and bringing in all the environmental data. When you do these games, there's a huge swathe of environmental data that comes through with that, through the charcoal and environmental analysis. And we're quite lucky as well that a pollen core was done nearby as well. So, I think setting out a story map, if you like, really helps to bring all the information together. And that was just how we worked.
No, and the book really nicely integrates both that information within the text, but also incorporates text, graphs, and tables throughout the book, sort of fully more explaining what is in there in the text. And then a lot of the podcast listeners tend to be even later than my time period. So I tend to cover the earliest, you cover even earlier. They tend to focus primarily on modern stuff. So with such a focus also then on Kells and its monastery and this focus, why should scholars and the public look at the prehistory of the site and the surrounding area? What makes it so vitally important?
Well, I suppose the information that we've gathered tells the story of, you know, or maybe it gives inference about why this area became important. But it's really telling the origin story, if you like, or the it's the prehistory. So people have been living in this landscape for 4,000 years, more than 4,000 years before Kells were established, obviously. And that would be true for a lot of landscapes in Ireland. Meath is particularly archaeologically rich as well, but it was interesting to build up the backstory to the hinterlands of Kells and how over time that landscape developed and the nature of the archaeology leading up to the establishment of Kells as well, or establishment of Kells as an important centre in prehistory and history, basically. So I suppose the road scheme itself is just a small snapshot of the landscape. Effectively, it's a corridor that's in general randomly, it's a random sample of the landscape. What we have here is just it's just a small little sample of what the bigger picture will be, but it does give you an idea about how population has changed over time, the level of, I suppose, interaction with the landscape, and how we can see through the book and through the evidence how there's fluctuations in population growth and decline, etc., and where the concentrations of activity are centered, you know. So it all ties together and leads up to that point, I suppose. But the prehistory itself is very interesting. There's some very important discoveries here.
And it's such a foundational time period, especially because then you see life and you see the vibrancy of it, but you also see how incredibly resilient the people are with looking at the different populations and how they move, and how there are some unusual aspects to it that you don't necessarily see elsewhere, but also that it's the potential for more, seeing how people interact in this landscape. So with this, for those unfamiliar, the excavations, as you mentioned before, were published in the book, were the product of rescue archaeology, so carried out prior to the highway and the bypass. What were some of the upsides and downsides of conducting this type of archaeology here?
Well, I suppose the upside is, I suppose in one way it provides a unique opportunity to set for look at a sample of the archaeological landscape, because when the road is built, everything within that wellave or everything in the footprint of the road is investigated fully. So there's geophysical surveys, there was test trenching to identify sites, and then those sites were fully excavated. So there was quite a number of sites to be excavated over time, and it just creates a huge body of information and archaeological resource, you know, to build from. I suppose some of the downsides, it was a long-term excavation over a year anyway. So that meant working in some difficult conditions. I think there was times there when we were working in Dunedin that it seemed to rain every single day and we had every type of rain imaginable. Tricky to work during the winter, with delicate archaeology as well, but overall very satisfying in the results at the end of the day.
And then going off of that, many sites are multi-period, like Kilmainham, as you just mentioned, while others are single, whether that's Ballybeg. Did there either have advantages and or disadvantages? And are there any trends regarding movement or reasons as to why this might have happened?
Okay, so in some ways, this might be slightly arbitrary in a way, because some of the larger sites, the more complex sites, were found in areas where there was more land taken by the road, if you know what I mean. So that Kilmainham was a large interchange built at that location. So there was a much larger landscape tract investigated. And within that area, we found nearly every phase or every period of prehistory across that area. It gave an opportunity to look at the landscape in a kind of a wider context. You know, if you move into the other parts of the road scheme itself, the road corridor is quite narrow. So, and in some of those narrow road corridors, we found more isolated archaeology, pits like Ballybeg or some of the Burt Mounds, etc. But in the larger excavation areas, I suppose, we found a wide range of archaeology through numerous phases. And at Kilmainham, we have archaeology spanning the early Neolithic, right through the Neolithic into the late Neolithic Bronze Age, all periods of the Bronze Age into the Iron Age and into the early medieval period as well. So a full picture there, really. But the peripheral archaeology were, you know, across the rest of the scheme, in some instances where you just find isolated features or small little pockets, they tell the story, they tell their own story, you know, that away from maybe focal areas or areas of increased activity, there's still peripheral activity, like people going out and little hunting camps being found away from the main focus or the main settlements, are you know, industrial features like kilns and that type of thing, were actually try to keep them away from settlement focus. So it all goes up into the bigger picture, really.
And then how does, you talked about the natural landscape, how big of a role did that play in shaping the inhabitants and vice versa?
I suppose there's many sites, many Bronze Age Burt Mounds of Fulltree found along the scheme, and, you know, they're typically found in dryland wetland at the faces, you know, close to water source, where the water is needed to operate these sites. So basically, you know, the Fulltree, hot stones are heated on a fire and dropped into a trough of water to bring the water to boil to cook meat or bathing, or, you know, there's lots of different ideas about what they were used for. So, you know, that in some cases their location of them are dictated by landscape variations. You know, some of the other settlement sites are on nice flat plateaus, in some cases with nice vistas, etc. At Cakestown Glebe, there was, you know, you get a sense that the inhabitants were wary of the underlying geology, even to the point of the landscape, because there's a lovely free drying gravel ridge overlooking the Blackwater, you know. So, like, some of those locations were always nice and dry, elevated, in good locations, with the river itself running right through the landscape. And the river, Blackwater River, was like a major natural feature in the landscape. You can imagine, you know, it ties into the Boyne at Navan, then flows out to the Irish Sea, and would have been a major routeway. You can imagine some of the earliest inhabitants would have travelled the river up into the heartlands, you know. So it was, I suppose it was a natural source of food, and it was also a major routeway, the major routeway before some of the roads were built.
And then, to what extent did the scientific evidence, so the paleoecology, radiocarbon dating, etc., inform upon and fill in the gaps of knowledge developed from the artifact or structural analysis?
Well, that's it. So the obviously, through analysis of finds and pottery and feature types and even house types, you know, you can get a pretty good idea of the periods and the main occupation periods. Like in the early Neolithic period, we've very clearly defined the early Neolithic houses, lovely big square, or rectangular houses that were very clear and defined. Some of the radiocarbon dates, we were very focused on the type of radiocarbon dates that we took and what how we selected samples, etc., to really try to refine what we already knew about them and try to refine the dates for those. But the radiocarbon dates as a collective data set for the whole scheme is very interesting, because when we plotted them across the board, you can see fluctuations in population over time periods. So obviously population and the archaeological evidence is quite low for the lateness of the period in this area. As you come into the early Neolithic period, you see an increase in activity, like in every other parts of the country, in these kind of low-lying areas. You know, as you get into the middle Neolithic, the evidence drops off. It starts to increase again as you go into the late Neolithic, where we have evidence of timber circular pronaeum and other late Neolithic pottery and other sites. As you go into the Bronze Age, then you see a gradual increase in activity and population as well. And this is common trend across Ireland, you know, around the middle Bronze Age peak. It was nearly a boom time, you feel it in Ireland. And that's, you can see these trends in the radiocarbon dating evidence as well in the graphs, because you go into the late Bronze Age and then into the Iron Age, and there's a big drop off again. And the Iron Age, or as the Iron Age, I suppose, has been characterized in some cases as the Dark Ages, and for a reason, you know, there's big fluctuation of population there before it increases again, get into the early etc. So it's interesting to see that. And you can also see in the graphs as well, volcanic eruptions, etc., where that comes into play, tying in with the use of, or the boom in seal drying kilns. So fluctuations in weather, where you need it more, seal drying kilns to dry the grain, etc. So it all ties together.
One of the most well-known structures of the late Neolithic period is Stonehenge. Could you talk more about the Cumainham III ceremonial complex?
So the Cumainham III timber circle, very interesting site, and we mused over this as to its interpretation. That said, that the I should have maybe said start as well. The book has been written with in consultation with a lot of different specialists and archaeological experts and environmentalists. The academic editor for this book was Dr. Owen Rogan, and he was instrumental in coming across with a lot of the ideas of interpretation and how the book was formed as well, how we get the information across. But we did talk quite a bit about Cumainham III. It would have been obviously a wooden structure. We believe it would be freestanding. There was two other smaller timber circles just to the north and south of it as well. So looking at all that, we had to come up with an interpretation of those remains. You know, I suppose if you look at the Stonehenge landscape, Stonehenge is seen as related to burial and burial practices, etc. Whereas timber circles are seen to be more into monuments celebrating life, I suppose. So if stone is for the dead, then wood is for life. So we've interpreted that site as a place of celebration, you know, for social gatherings to celebrate. Harvests are different times during the year, but also, like, there's clear evidence there at the Cumainham where there's offerings made as people enter the site, whether they're placing special objects into the portals as they enter the site, or making even ritual deposition of some Cumainham bone, etc., that type of thing, but also potentially feasting as well. Feasting is the word, I'm not sure, but at least having food as part of the ceremonies of the day.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Which is something that you see even, I know at least from my research, you see it even later within the time period. You see it in the early medieval period, the ritual feasting. Aside from, you just mentioned specific depositions, but you also talk about this in the book with particularly beakerware. Are there any other signs of structured deposits at the sites?
Well, as I say, at Kilmainham 3, at the Timber Circle, there are very specific deposits in certain features as part of those ceremonies. But the deliberate deposition of material or objects into the foundations of buildings, something that you see across the millennia, is almost ingrained into the human psyche in some kind of form. Because I know that in Ireland it still happens as well, that when a house has been built, that people may put special objects into the foundations of buildings, just to as part of the at the construction stage, you know. So we do see even in the houses that objects are placed in the foundations of the houses there. We saw evidence of it there in the Bronze Age as well, at the Grange Bronze Age structures, where it seemed that objects were placed into the foundation trenches. I suppose it's all down to the bigger picture of legitimizing place and connection to the buildings and to the homes as well. But as you say, in the Beaker period, it seems to be a very specific thing. And there's been a lot written about the deposition of Beaker material into features. We see it at Kilmainham as well, where Beaker pottery has been placed into a specific purpose.
Thinking about along these lines of ideas of purposeful construction, why should we view the features, including the burnt mounds, that you talk about, that is talked about in the book? You on page 107, there was a really quote that I really liked was, as part of a mosaic of settlement features in an occupied, organized landscape, and not only as isolated features in marginal settings. So why should we view these features as being part of that?
I suppose it's specifically about burnt mounds. There's a lot of I suppose, interpretation about what they were used for. I suppose, and they are really cooking sites. I suppose the question there is, you know, their location is selective in terms of being accessible to water, but they're also probably in the periphery of settlement as well. But who owned them, I suppose, is the other question. And were they communal? Could be open to various people or various family groups using them at any time. So I suppose, they are one of the more common sites, whether they're probably the most common site. But if you look at it, you have a multi-purpose site that's used for various activities across the spectrum, across landscapes, on nearly every scheme that we investigate. So they are part of the social fabric in that kind of way, you know.
In the book, you also talk about, with the aspect of living life and people living together, you talk about the evolution of housing, which is common and expected considering the large span of time period in the book. But you mention in the book that the late Bronze Age reverted. Could you explain that further and whether there are any indications as to possibly why?
Well, this is just part of the trends that we see across the board, you know, fluctuation in house types. If you go back to the early Neolithic, you've got what seem to be very sturdy, well-built, rectangular houses. They're quite large, you know. Some of them would probably be the same size as historic Irish vernacular cottages, you know. that seems to be a bit of, you know, the exception to the rule in terms of in the Vedic period, because as you move on from there, the that phenomenon of the early Vedic large rectangular house dies off, and into the middle and late Vedic, you don't, the evidence for structure remains is a lot slighter, you know, it's not as pronounced and harder to find in the archaeological record as well. And similarly, you see the same thing in the Bronze Age, only this time with large round houses, where you come into the middle Bronze Age and find a number of very large circular houses, very well constructed, and leave a very distinguished archaeological trace. But again, as you move into the late Bronze Age, you don't seem to see that. The evidence that we get are, again, this is just a snapshot of this overall landscape, but the structural remains of those houses seem to be a lot slighter, not as well built, and not, can't be sure what's going on there, but there's definitely fluctuations. And maybe in the late Bronze Age, population focus moves away from the wider landscape, and there's a bit more focus into more centralized habitation on fields, etc. So,
and then looking into this, in the book, you how did then moving from life to thinking about death, how did the funerary landscape and then the burials rituals change over time and space?
Or the lack of burial evidence as well, because in the early Neolithic period, we have no evidence of burial in our archaeological record for this scheme, but that's, you know, that's to say then that the burials were happening elsewhere in tombs, etc., centralized communal settings, collectively. So that feature of the Neolithic, obviously, and then into the Bronze Age, you see more individual burials in cremations, etc. And actually, at Comenum, we actually find some cremation deposits in a large rock outcrop just in the middle of that area, which is unusual in some form, but the cremations were actually placed into hollows or into gaps in the rock itself. Now, like in terms of burial markers, it's a natural stone outcrop, but that was utilized as a focal for burial. And again, as you move through the Bronze Age, we have isolated cremations in groups in different parts of the scheme, and then moving into the late Iron Age or medieval period, you see collective burials in grave cups, etc. But sometimes, as we kind of see, that these are deliberately placed, or locations are chosen to legitimize boundaries between groups, etc. And we saw that at Grange. So another question there might be that the absence of burials in the scheme doesn't necessarily give the full picture, because it's all depending on whether burials are communal, focused, and maybe outside of the scheme, or maybe a bit more across the board. And it's, you know, the isolated burials and cremations, etc., that you'd expect is what we're picking up in some of these schemes as well.
Oh. And then how does this area, looking at this, compare to the evidence in the Blackwater Valley in the vicinity of Kells, compare to the rest of Ireland, and how does it increase our knowledge of the prehistoric period within Ireland?
Well, I suppose the area that the road scheme traverses here is kind of quite agriculturally rich, good land, basically. And I suppose it always would have been attractive in that sense for settlers. So land is good now, it was always good. And it's I suppose, probably one of the more attractive areas archaeologically in the past. But I suppose we do find, have found in this game, very similar range of sites and evidence that you expect to find in other parts of Ireland. But I think significantly what we found, and maybe one of the more interesting elements or the more important elements of this, is that, you know, the Neolithic evidence that we found here is quite would be at Bolton Arm, I suppose. You know, we found numerous Nunavik houses in one particular area around that Cailneenan area, not just in Cailneenan, but just around the Kells area, different little pockets of the habitation. The Nunavik house at Times Park was a beautiful example of this. So again, as a snapshot, you can imagine that area as a whole, because what we investigated was arbitrary in some form, that there could have been a much wider habitational landscape around there, quite intensive, it seems. So that was particularly interesting because of the numbers and quality of the little activity in that area, I suppose. At Kilmainham, the pottery assemblage is probably one of the larger pottery assemblages that's been found in Ireland to date. It's probably a more interest. Actually, my biggest interest is in the Neolithic period, so I might be a bit biased there as well. So.
That's completely all right. And then what was your favorite part of the book?
We'll just go back to what we said before, trying to get all the information together. There's a lot of scientific data, very factual, actually misinformation that we need to get across in the book. As I said before, we try to put a lot of that detail into tables. There's a lot of detail in the back of the book with the actual radiocarbon dates, so the specialist data, etc. And obviously, there's tables at the back as well that link to the digital resource, the DRI, that has all of the final reports. So there is scope back to the original material for researchers, etc. So by condensing the book into a narrative sequentially through time, it's a conscious decision, but probably my favorite part of the book, or parts of the book, is where we've separated the narrative into more conjecture. So for a number of the chapters, we have separated gray texts or gray boxes where we've maybe discussed this is what life around the Neolithic settlement would have been or could have been like in the Neolithic period. And we did it for the Timber Circle as well at Cailneenan, where we could just go a bit beyond the facts, I suppose, put conjecture on it and maybe tell a bit of a story. So even talking about the Neolithic house at Times Park, we could go into the detail where, like as archaeologists, we always find strange features that we can never interpret fully. But we could say, well, why can this not just be a pig wallowing pit or something like that? We talk about the hedges and the boundaries for safe areas for children to play, etc. And there is that these houses were, linked by well-trodden paths between other wider family groups, etc. And that the houses were places for shelter, security, to tell the stories, everything like that. But I have to say that the reconstruction images in the book by Dan Tyler are excellent in the sense that he took the original plans from the excavations and extrapolated up the evidence from that based on three-dimensional drawings. So they are actually very correct in that sense. And then whenever we were theorizing what the wider landscape would look like, we just didn't draw in some hedges per se. We made calls to experts in that field, like Barry Mattachi, in terms of what would a hedge row look like in the period, and drew it on that. So, they are conjecture, but they are based on evidence and also discussions with people who know and new ideas, like the Cailneenan 3 Timber Circle is evidence of that, where we have a circle of post holes. Some may interpret it as being a roof structure, some others as an open structure, which is poles, etc. There's lots of different ways of looking at that. But it does give an insight and separate the conjecture and interpretation a little bit from the factual evidence of the book as well. So I think that worked quite well.
Thank you so much, Fintan, for joining me today to talk about your book.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you.
No, it was really, I really enjoyed talking with you and hearing more about the ideas and aspects related to it beyond just the page. So Fintan Walsh's book, as well as many others who contributed to the book, The Road to Kells, Prehistoric Archaeology of the M3 Navan to Kells and N52 Kells Bypass Road Project, is available now through World War Books and Transport Infrastructure Ireland. If you'd like to hear more episodes, subscribe to New Books on Irish Studies on the New Books Network website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, stay safe and keep reading.